Ready to launch your business? Get started with the commerce platform made for entrepreneurs. Shopify is specially designed to help you start, run, and grow your business with easy customizable themes that let you build your brand, marketing tools that get your products out there, integrated shipping solutions that actually save you time. From startups to scale-ups, online, in person, and on the go, Shopify is made for entrepreneurs like you.
Sign up for your $1 a month trial at shopify.com/setup.
Hello and welcome to Immigrantly. I'm your host, Sadia Khan. A few days ago, I was having a conversation with somebody in my community about Immigrantly Media and the incredible work we are doing. I mentioned our recent Sportly episode on pickleball, how it resonated so deeply with our audience. And his response caught me off guard. He said almost dismissively that he had no interest in listening to a podcast episode about pickleball from a second-gen kid of immigrants of Asian descent on an immigrant lifestyle platform. That comment stuck with me. Not in a good way, but in a way that made me reflect. So I asked him, why? Why couldn't second or third gen talk about pickleball? And his answer, because it doesn't fit the immigrant narrative. I sighed so loudly. Because seriously, what's frustrating and unsurprising is that even within our own communities, we have internalized these narrow, one-dimensional ideas of what immigrants can and cannot do and what they should talk about. As if our identities are confined to stories of struggle, assimilation, and survival. As if we aren't whole, multifaceted human beings with diverse interests, experiences, and perspectives. And that's why platforms like Immigrantly exist, to push back against these limiting narratives, to celebrate the full spectrum of our humanity, and to remind the world that we are not just immigrants. We are individuals with rich, multidimensional lives. So, if you are an immigrant, a descendant of immigrants, or simply someone who values nuanced storytelling, support us. Spread the word. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts. Listen to our podcasts. Share them with a friend, a family member, a skeptic, and follow us on our socials. By the way, today we are talking about something this person would expect us to cover: immigration. And joining me to talk about immigration is Claudia Yoli Furla. She is someone who's not just advocating for change, but embodying it. And you know this, right? In today's America, immigration remains a political battleground. Claudia has made it her life's work to challenge that exclusion for herself and for an entire generation of young marginalized voters. Born in Venezuela and raised in El Paso, Claudia is a DACA recipient, a Latina, and the executive director of Move Texas. She is on the front lines of civic engagement, mobilizing young people to claim power in a state that has historically tried to silence them. But how do we push for reform when the political landscape keeps shifting beneath our feet? To talk about this and so much more, let's dive in. Hi, Claudia. Welcome to Immigrantly.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I am really excited to have you here. But a lot has been happening in the last month, not month, maybe 10, 15 days. And I just wanted to check in and see how is your heart today?
I appreciate this question because I think the heart of many Americans is probably feeling a little bit, you know, not so great. It's funny that you say it's been less than a month. I was literally doing my timesheet this morning. We run on a biweekly payroll at my organization and the payroll starting like literally the date of inauguration. And I'm like, y'all, it's only been one pay period. And I feel like I am living in a different democracy than I was at the beginning of this year. But I appreciate the question. The heart feels heavy, but the spirit feels ready to fight. And I think that that is the truth for many Americans today.
I love that classification of heart versus spirit. And I'm so glad that your spirit is ready to fight. As I was prepping for this interview, I decided to go on a website and just look through the executive orders that have been passed regarding immigration. And I thought we'll just do this fun exercise. I will go through just the titles and the names of these executive orders. And I kid you not, as I was reading through them, I was like, what the fuck is this? I'll read through them. And then I want to get your take on what do they really mean? Because as you said, there's a lot of uncertainty. People are scared. They're worried. They don't know what to expect, where to go from here. So the first one is protecting the United States from foreign terrorists and other national security and public safety threats. Protecting the meaning and value of American citizenship. Securing our borders and declaring a national emergency at the southern border of the United States. Executive order protecting the American people against invasion. Executive order guaranteeing the state's protections against invasion. Realigning the United States refugee admissions program. Terms like invasion and meaning of citizenship. And I know this is not funny, but what the hell is going on? This is really dog whistling, right? This is pandering to a particular constituency. What are your thoughts on this? And what do they really mean, all these different executive orders regarding immigration?
I think that, you know, you mentioned earlier, there's so many, right? And I know that you're like only at the very surface level sharing some of these names. And I think that the point, right, of all of these executive orders that we're seeing come out from the Trump administration, it feels like we're catching up with one headline before we receive another, is exactly that, right? Like the point of all of this is to create confusion, to create chaos, and more importantly, to create disinformation. When I hear the words invasion, I think it's so wild. It is like something that I can't even wrap my mind around. Invasion at the southern border. You know, I'm a proud product of immigrants, right? I am a proud product of the DACA program. I am a TPS recipient. And I grew up most of my life, in fact, undocumented in a border community in El Paso. And when I think of border communities, the last thing that goes through my mind is an invasion of immigrants. The first thing that does come to mind, though, is the hardworking, everyday people of that community that helped my single mother raise me, right? And what I think about that community, I think about the words dignity. I think about the words humanity. I think about the word safety. El Paso, for many years, was one of the safest cities because we had the contributions of everyday hardworking immigrants. We are made safe by the diversity, right? And by immigrant communities all across this country. When I think of the word, the meaning of citizenship, what does that even mean? What I can tell you, though, is that the recent immigrant executive orders by the Trump administration are not only cruel and inhumane, but they're also unconstitutional, right? And this one specifically is attacking birthright citizenship that directly violates the 14th Amendment, which is a cornerstone of our democracy that guarantees citizenship for all people born in this country. And so undermining this principle is an attack at the very foundation of what it even means to be an American, right? The meaning of being an American. It's been really hard to see these news. But again, I see so much inspiration from the countless of protests that have happened across the country. You know, some people refusing to show up to work or to spend their resources and spend their dollars on Monday across a national strike. To me, that is the definition of democracy. That is what democracy looks like. And that is why I say that this country's spirit is really in fighting mode.
I'm glad that we are talking about this because theoretically, yes, I understand that these are being passed. But practically, what are some of the practical implications of these executive orders, if any at all? Because you just mentioned, especially birthright citizenship, changing that idea is unconstitutional. It goes against the 14th Amendment. So where does that leave us then?
Well, it leaves us in a place of a lot of chaos, confusion, and disinformation, right? And very real anti-immigrant tactics that have already been taken by the Trump administration. I'm sure everybody's already seen the headlines on the raids that are happening, the ICE raids happening. I live in Austin currently, and there was a raid about 7 days into the Trump inauguration. And raiding elementary schools and terrorizing children, right? And terrorizing hardworking people to the point where they're too scared to show up to work, too scared to literally drive in the streets, even if it's just to get groceries, just to shop for groceries, does not make our community safer. And the truth is that also all of this is not even rooted in any kind of rational or good public plan. On top of the raids, we also have seen the headlines on mass deportations, which again are not rational. They're not good for the public, as Trump and his administration claims, or even based on sound policy. Because the reality is that all of these plans and the reason why many of his supporters ended up voting for him was because of the conversation on economy. We know that immigrants are hardworking people who are here providing every single day to our economy. And so all of these plans have absolutely nothing with supporting the economy or supporting businesses, but rather it's just a strategy to scapegoat entire groups of people to further sow division and hate in an effort to distract from the fact that he and his billionaire cronies, which are the minority of the people in this country, the top 1%, make a profit off of ICE raids, make a profit out of mass deportation and the expansion of even detention camps, which we were seeing also some news, report on that and so much more. And all while you and I, the actual hardworking taxpayer people in this country, will have to foot the bill on mass deportation and detention.
PSA for anyone who rents. If you haven't heard of Built, you are about to thank me. Earning points on rent is now a reality when you pay your rent through Built. You don't even have to check with your landlord to start earning points that you can use toward flights, hotel stays, fitness classes, and even your next rent payment. Let me break it down for you. There's no cost to join Built, and as a member, you'll earn valuable points on rent and on your everyday spending. Built points can be transferred to your favorite hotels and airlines, and even the ones you haven't heard of. There are over 500 airlines and 700,000 hotels and properties around the world you can redeem your Built points toward. Points can also be redeemed towards a future rent payment and unique experiences that only Built members can access. How incredible is that? So, if you're not earning points on rent, my question is, why not? Start earning points on rent you're already paying by going to joinbuilt.com/immigrantly. That's joinbuilt.com/immigrantly. Make sure to use our URL so they know we sent you. joinbuilt.com/immigrantly to start earning points on your rent payments today. Claudia, I want to step back and talk about deportation. Now, this is not a new phenomenon. This has happened under Democrats. It has happened under Republicans. I mean, Obama was called deporter-in-chief. Biden did a lot of deportations, right? So we cannot absolve Democrats of this responsibility. When we think of mass deportations, yes, Trump administration and the Republicans are making it more explicit. There is a lot of negative rhetoric, especially around this. But this has been happening. We know that. And I will come back to that, but let's go back to birthright citizenship. Now, according to this executive order, any child born on or after February 19th, 2025, to parents who are, say, on temporary visa, will not be granted citizenship at birth. Can that be enacted? Will that happen? Is that something that parents who are on temporary visas should be prepared for?
Absolutely not. It is a completely unconstitutional executive order for a president. First of all, a president does not have the unilateral power to change the constitution in this country, right? That is why this constitution and our democracy was designed in a system of checks and balances. And so he cannot unilaterally, with the stroke of a pen, do that and take that right away for millions of Americans living in this country. What I can tell you is that there has already been several counter lawsuits that have been filed against the Trump administration and the U.S. government around this specific executive order. There was one led by a group, civil rights organizations like the ACLU. And then also another lawsuit, if I'm not incorrect, that was led by 18 different states that are also saying, hey, you can't take this right away. And then for him to be able to actually conduct that, right, he would need a supermajority vote in Congress, which is about 2/3 of a vote in Congress to support that, which we clearly know he does not have the numbers, and or go through a process of conducting what they call a state constitution. That state constitution's process, right, would mean that certain states have to come together to change and ratify the constitution, which has been something that has been tried for many years in this country, but has never happened. And so I think when we really look at the power of the president, the power of the executive branch, yes, this is the most powerful individual in the entire Western Hemisphere. However, the power of this country truly rests with the people who decide who do we put in office, the people who are able to hold their elected officials and corporations accountable through the power of their vote and the power of their spending. And when we really look at what is the point of this executive order, right, it really actually sits on the biggest power that a president has, which is the power of the rhetoric. I think that Trump is a master rhetor-in-chief, meaning that he sometimes, Congress could be working on something like healthcare reform or whatever, right? And then all of a sudden he comes on the news, talks about something very differently, and then the news cycle follows. And so I think that for anybody looking at this, for any people who are here, maybe undocumented or here on some sort of temporary status, looking at this, worried that this might impact them, know in your heart, right, that there are organizations and leaders who are fighting this, in the courts, and that this is deeply unconstitutional and should concern not just those that would be directly impacted, but literally any citizen who cares about our democracy in this country. I myself, I'm a DACA and DPS recipient. It is wild to think about a future where maybe my child would not be a U.S. citizen simply because of partisan gridlock.
Claudia, I want to go back to deportation now. When they talk about mass deportations and emergency at the border, it seems so scary, dystopian, right? Mm-hmm. How do you see it play out differently than what was happening under Biden or Obama, for that matter?
You were spot on earlier when you shared that deportation and mass deportation has always been an issue in this country under every political party, right? And the reality is that in order to avoid using taxpayer dollars and in order to avoid these mass deportation efforts that are, of course, going to be, I think, accelerated by an anti-immigrant administration like Trump's administration, we really have to talk about immigration reform, which has been a political issue for decades. And unfortunately, comprehensive immigration reform has not been achieved because of that partisan gridlock, because of that polarization and failure to address both enforcement, right, which is important to talk about, but also humanitarian concerns all at the same level in tandem, right? For years, and I'm talking about for decades, ever since I moved to this country when I was 8 years old, I remember, putting on the news on Univision, Reforma Migratoria, always coming up on the news.
That the best way to solve this problem is by working together to pass that kind of common sense law. But until that happens, there are actions I have the legal authority to take as president, the same kinds of actions taken by Democratic and Republican presidents before me, that will help make our immigration system more fair and more just.
This bipartisan bill is the best opportunity to move forward. Many Americans are rightly skeptical about immigration reform. I strongly believe the bipartisan Senate bill addresses the reasons for past failures.
For more than 30 years, politicians have talked about immigration reform, and we've done nothing about it. It's time to fix it.
Democratic and Republican leaders have stonewalled legislation year after year, Congress session after Congress session, that would have already protected immigrant youth like me under a clean pathway to citizenship like the DREAM Act. You know, opportunities to deliver this pathway of citizenship for millions of people in this country, there's more than now 12 million undocumented people in this country, have been abandoned in place of expanding, you know, private detention centers. Who, at the end of the day, who benefits from that? The only people who benefit from that are the pockets of billionaires and corporations who profit off of detaining our loved ones. And so that is what we're under. I think we're beyond a point of conversation around just needing comprehensive immigration reform. I believe that it is possible that we will achieve it. And the day that we achieve it, it's because, again, of the courageous immigrants and their allies who have taken these demands to the streets and who are actively calling their members in Congress to ensure that they take action. But unfortunately, we're at a point in this country where we should actually be talking about compassionate immigration reform. The way we talk about our immigrant families, the way we talk about our immigrant communities matters, and it matters deeply.
You've talked about your own status as a DACA recipient, and DACA recipients have been used as political pawns for years, right? And they offered protections one moment and then threatened with deportation the next. I really want to understand if you think the program's existence has in some ways stalled broader immigration reform, or do you think what Obama did, which many do not know, was not like he just waved a magic wand and it happened. There was a lot of advocacy, a lot of community and capacity building happening in the background by youth to achieve DACA. But do you think DACA was more of a, you know, temporary solution to a bigger problem? And do you think it's time for us to look at immigration holistically?
I love that you said that the DACA program was not one where President Obama just like waved his wand and all of a sudden there's a new executive order, although it kind of feels like that under this new Trump administration, like we're waving wands.
Yeah, because Obama takes a lot of credit for it. Honestly, there are so many people who deserve credit, and unfortunately, they don't get it.
Absolutely. I'm proud to be part of the generation of young people and young organizers who won the protections of the DACA program in the streets, in the halls of power, continued community organizing. What I can tell you is that DACA is a program that, for me very personally, right, did change my life in a really positive way. It was a program that allowed me to have a work authorization, which meant that I could legally work in this country. That meant that I was able to not only pay for some of my school, but also allow myself the ability to sustain myself and allow to also sustain my family members, especially those back home, my home country of Venezuela. The second thing that it did was provide me with a protection from deportation. At the time when DACA was rolled out, I was actually in removal proceedings, and it was an executive order and a program that allowed me to essentially administratively close that case and continue to feel that, you know, safety from deportation. Although when we classify all immigrants under, you know, terrible terms, no immigrant, regardless of protections, regardless of immigration status, is safe. What I absolutely know and what has always been very clear for these young advocates and these young organizers is that DACA was never the end all be all, right? That DACA was a temporary solution. We experience that temporary solution every 2 years when we have to reapply for the program, where we have to essentially reapply for our work authorizations, when we have to essentially live our life court order decision by decision, right? Yes, this is a program that it has been under attack since the first Trump administration that has been, you know, courageously fought in the courts, but it's also a program that continues to hang on by a thread. And I am so sick and tired of politicians on both sides of the aisle, because we also have a lot of Republicans who claim, oh, well, we love the Dreamers. We love DACA recipients. It's not their fault that they're here and they're great members of society. Like this bullshit narrative that at the end of the day hurts our communities. It hurts the ways that we see ourselves like ingrained in our communities. And these politicians on both sides of the aisles, right, if they really, really did care, they would stop using our stories, our advocacy, our power as political trading chips, and instead actually come to the table to work on common sense solutions on the issue of immigration. Because what I think every American at this point can agree on, despite your views on immigration, is that we have a broken immigration system that needs some fixing.
Also, every American should know that except for the native population, every American in this country, no matter how far removed they are, maybe five generations, six generations, they have a connection to immigrant identity and they are a descendant of an immigrant, whether they like it or not. But I do want to talk about something that you mentioned. When we think of DACA, now much of the mainstream immigration conversation around DACA has also centered on model immigrants within, you know, undocumented immigrant communities, right? DACA recipients, they go to college, they are hardworking, they stay out of trouble. But honestly, this narrative leaves out so many undocumented immigrants who do not fit into this one mold. So how do we build a movement that involves undocumented immigrants who are not necessarily seen through that lens?
I love this conversation so much because I think I myself have been, you know, one of those people that has always fought to like have the perfect grades, right? To have the perfect performance at my job, to have the perfect criminal record to ensure that I'm not, you know, at the receiving end of another deportation order. And so I think that it is a narrative that impacts the entire immigrant community, that the way that the entire immigrant community is looked at. And what I can tell you, only speaking very personally from my own very personal experience, is that it also adds a lot of pressure to those of us that are at the receiving end of that narrative. And what I can also say is that, you know, I am in this country because I have a mother, or my mother was very brave enough to leave everything behind in her country. She was a lawyer with a passion for social justice who was, you know, kind of seeing what was at play in the, and then the political uncertainty like rising in my country. I made the bold choice and the tough, courageous decision to come to this country. And so that my story cannot be disconnected from the story of somebody like my mother. And my story cannot be disconnected from the 12 other million plus stories in this country when it comes to the conversation around immigration. We need to, again, have not only comprehensive immigration reform from a policy perspective, but what I mentioned earlier, compassionate immigration reform that really just centers on the dignity and the humanity and the safety of all immigrants and all people across the state, right? And all across this country. You know, at Move Texas, the organization that I'm proud to lead, which is an organization that works to build the political power of young people in a state like Texas, we fight for a democracy because we believe that a democracy should reflect and include all of us, regardless of where we're born, regardless of our race, regardless of our age, regardless of our income. And again, so much of these conversations around policy and executive orders and new administration and elections, it's not just that, it's deeply personal because politics is personal for so many of us.
Absolutely. And even beyond compassion, it's human centricity. It's about human experiences that can be messy, whether documented or undocumented. Immigrants can make mistakes and they don't have to be perfect and they don't have to be model minority or perfect humans, because perfection within humanity does not exist for anyone, right? So why do we expect it from immigrants? But I do want to talk about young voters. You've mentioned it. You work with young voters. The way I see it, many Gen Z and millennial activists argue that voting is an inherently flawed and slow-moving mechanism for change. We've seen a lot of people don't want to vote. I was listening to one of your interviews where you talk about making voting and the process itself, civic engagement, more fun and exciting for young folks, which to me is great. But I wonder if that takes away from the agency and intentionality around voting. But for young folks who are really disillusioned by the process itself, how do you create interest in the electoral process for young folks especially?
Yeah, I think one thing we have to understand about young voters, whether they be young voters in a voter suppressed state like Texas or young voters in, you know, across this country, is that young voters are not going to show up, right, to vote for a political party or a political candidate. What young voters are going to turn out and vote for and dedicate their time and investment and energy towards are essentially the issues. Comprehensive immigration reform, climate change being a top issue for young voters that we hardly talked about or discussed during the last election cycle. Housing, jobs, making sure that we have access to higher education. A lot of these issues, if you think about it, are not issues that we really dived on in a national conversation during the last cycle. And so if a political party wants to not only secure the youth vote, they should also be, you know, investing into that demographic, right? Because it's not just about securing it for one cycle. It's about investing and realizing that young voters, unfortunately, we don't live in a country with a culture around civic engagement. We don't live, you know, and in particularly in Texas, even for those young voters that were so excited and so ready to turn out to vote, many of them were turned away because of super restrictive voting laws, right? I live in a state where we don't have access to online voter registration. Young people are always online. We have a state that has continuously targeted access to campus polling locations, meaning that if you are a student and you know, sometimes the best way for you to be able to vote, the most accessible way for you to be able to vote is simply to do it on your campus, on your college campus, right? We live in a state where a person with a handgun license can use that as a form of ID when going to vote, but unfortunately, a student ID is not acceptable. And so that should tell you, right, like all of these laws are not just simply there because they've been there. They are there by design, and they are there to keep the voices of young voters out of the process. And so we don't have a culture in civic engagement at all in this country that celebrates and that encourages the participation of young people to register to vote. In Texas, young people make up 1 out of every 3 eligible voters in the state. We are the largest voting generation and also one of the most diverse voting generations in history. And so the way that I like to see it is that we should be, right, in theory, seeing that diversity, that big piece of the pie with sprinkles and fun toppings on it reflected into the people we're electing into office. And more importantly, the policies that we're also enacting in our communities, which is unfortunately not the case in Texas and unfortunately not the case no longer in the United States. But however, I think one thing that I want to emphasize, right, is that I see young people every single day winning, right? Because when we turn out to, you know, share our story, when we turn out to maybe when we make that first step in registering to vote, which is, again, just one tool in the much larger toolbox of ways in which somebody could impact change in this country and in the state. And when we turn out to like fight these terrible things that are happening in our communities and in our state and in our country, that in itself, that act of activism, that sparks essentially an effort for change. And that is how we win, right? And that every single time we're showing up, we're winning. We're simply winning by continuing to show up.
Claudia, I am so glad you brought up this idea of how young voters are focused on issues. It is so important. And we just saw it play out in the last election cycle. There was a lot of assumptions around who young voters, especially voters of color, would vote for, right? But the reality is that young voters or multicultural, multiracial voters are no longer married to this idea of, oh, we are affiliated to this party versus that. They are very much focused on issues. And if any political party does not address those issues, they will not vote for them. So this idea of taking young voters, diverse voters for granted, I think it just fell flat.
I think that young voters want to see what every voters in this country want to see, right? Which is action on the issues that matter most to them. And for politicians that are elected to serve them, take these issues very seriously. And unfortunately, we're living in a country where the polarization of these issues has become essentially a political gridlock for anybody, whether it be, you know, people in Congress, people at city council, people at state legislatures, to actually take action on issues that matter to every single day voting Americans, including young people, right? Number one. Number two, I think the other important thing to mention and talk about is the fact that young people also know that like these systems are not necessarily working for them. And when I say the system, I don't just mean, right, like the different ways in which they're like, for example, in a state like Texas, their vote, it is really hard for them to access, right, like that ability to vote at the ballot box. I'm also talking about the way that like political campaigns in this country are designed, right? We have essentially thousands and millions of dollars that are spent. I don't even know the number from last election cycle at the national level of how much millions of dollars we spent. And I wonder, right, if like these political parties actually took their time to create a strategy that talked to young people. And then what happens after an election cycle? It's like, oh, like we're moving on, the headlines move on. And so again, the importance of year-round organizing, which is the model, the theory of change of Move Texas, is really, truly important. And again, we exist as an organization because we're filling in these gaps that the government and the political parties are failing to fill for specifically this demographic of young people. You know, my vision for Move Texas is for one day for it not to have to exist, because we have fulfilled our mission in ensuring that young people are at the driving seats of our democracy and in the halls of power.
So talk to me about some of the issues that mattered to young folks in the last election cycle and were not addressed by presidential candidates.
I think that while in policy, right, there was discussions, I think the messaging could have probably did fall flat on both sides of the aisle when it came to a lot of issues that were very important to young people. The conversation around climate change and how does climate change, you know, what is the government at both political sides of the aisle doing to actively address the issue of climate change, which is the most pressing issue across humanity. Like, we know we have a ticking clock when it comes to being able to take action on climate. Number two, right, housing and the economy, right? Many young people cannot, I myself, I'm a millennial, I can't afford a home. Like, that is a reality that many of us live in. And that is with a good paying job with benefits, cannot afford a home. And so while there were some good policy solutions, I'm not quite sure that those policy solutions were, you know, shared in a way in a message that was digestible for young people and first-time voters. I think often, you know, another important third issue that I want to name that I think many candidates circled around and used as inflammatory language to kind of point fingers at each other was the issue of the conflict and the war against Palestine, which unfortunately we're seeing how that is playing in real time. That thousands and thousands of people have, you know, lost their lives, their homes, their level of stability because of the U.S.'s involvement also in that conflict. And I do know that that was a determining factor, right? That's why my organization was proud to be one of the first organizations in Texas to loudly and unapologetically ask, you know, elected officials to take a stance on a permanent ceasefire, which allowed us to build that trust with the young people that we serve.
This is such an important conversation, and I'm really thankful to you that you brought up Gaza, because unfortunately, a lot of elected officials and mainstream media still doesn't want to acknowledge how big an issue Gaza was for young voters, for diverse voters. And economy, oh my gosh, why don't we talk about economy to young voters or diverse voters? Why do we assume that those issues don't matter? And climate change, we're seeing that like play out in real time. All the issues that you brought up were the issues that I thought would appeal to or matter to young voters, diverse voters, and were definitely not addressed, especially by the Democratic Party. That is the party that claims to believe in an ideology that addresses all these issues, and they did not. But I want to go back to Texas. Now, we've talked about Texas a few times. It is often described as on the verge of turning blue, right? It is going to turn blue very soon. Like, yet, year after year, it remains under conservative control. And I don't want to make this conversation about conservatism versus liberalism, but just in the context of Texas, from your vantage point, is this a false hope? Is it ever going to happen? Or are young voters actually capable of flipping the political script on Texas?
I think they already are, right? One thing I wanted, I should have mentioned earlier, and I want to mention it now, right, is that young voters in Texas and across the country have been deciding voting blocks in recent elections. One thing I want to name, particularly as it applies to Texas, is that, again, young voters are going to, when we are talking about having a democracy, right, in our state that is reflective of the voices, the lived experiences, the power the everyday realities of our people, Texas being one of the youngest, most diverse states in the nation, it cannot happen, right? Like that formula and that theory of change cannot happen without young voters as a part of that strategy. I personally don't do this work to elect, like I don't work for the Democratic Party. I don't do this work to elect Democrats. I think, you know, Move Texas does this work to serve those young people. And I think that they already are showing up in ways that sometimes that news might not actually cover. One of the ways, we just had a legislative session that started about, I want to say 4 weeks ago at the beginning of the month in January. And we're walking up against a Texas legislature that doesn't really care about everyday working people in the state. And one of the things that we are excited to, you know, to have introduced is our Get Shit Done agenda, which is a proactive agenda in a state like Texas.
I like that.
It is the energy that we need right now, right? We want politicians to do their job. And so despite the odds, we've introduced it. For us, it's going to be, you know, an agenda that focuses on our freedom to vote in the state and our rights as a voter in the state. The freedom to breathe clean air and leave behind a livable planet for generations to come. So we're going to be focused on climate issues. And then the freedom to choose if and when we want to have a family, right? And to have that freedom to belong and that freedom to have our autonomy on our own bodies and decisions. And so we're going to be focused also on gender justice as a core area of our work. But more importantly, one of the things that I'm really excited and what gives me so much hope in the state is an event that we're hosting, Youth Capital Takeover. It's the second time we're bringing it back. We did it in the 2023 legislative session. And Youth Capital Takeover is an event that is bringing partner organizations in Texas who also serve young people for a one day of action where we're going to essentially train young people about what is the legislative process? Like, why is this process designed to essentially keep voices like you out of the process? How do we take back that power? How do we take back this building that at the end of the day does not belong to the special interest groups, does not belong to the, you know, elected officials and the lobbyists, it belongs to us, the people in Texas. And so we're going to be, you know, bringing in probably DJs like we did last time, drag queens, et cetera, to essentially really infuse, right, like that joy and that beauty that is our movement into back into the Capitol. And then, yeah, it's going to be an amazing day. We're hoping to engage more than 500 young people all across the state.
Claudia, with this new administration, we've seen a lot of rhetoric to quell protests and dissent and activism, right? How do you see that play out in what you are preparing in terms of events, protests, bringing all these young folks together on the streets? Is there fear among young people of how activism will look like in this new era of no protests, no activism, no dissent?
You know, the conversation of no dissent, no activism, no protests has already been happening, right? Like we saw the retaliation over history, but even more and more recent history last year around, you know, the protests in support of Palestine in college campuses. College campuses have always historically been places for freedom of speech in our nation's history, right? And so that is already happening. And despite all of that retaliation, what ended up happening? Young people continue to show up, right? Because every American, no matter where you stand on the political spectrum, should actually be paying close attention to what that really means for the democracy of this country. And what I can say to that is that, you know, we have unfortunately a regime at the national and in Texas that we've been dealing with for 30 years, because it's been Project 2025 in Texas for the last 30 years, that may be able to, through the power that they do have in numbers, right, in Congress and in state legislatures, they might be able to legislate away our rights. But what they cannot do and what they will never be able to do is to legislate away our power. And there is power in numbers, and the power of this country rests with the people of this country.
I love that. Now, Move Texas is all about building young power, right? But if you were to create your dream role where you could really control the political and social aspects of change, what would that role look like?
I think it would look like a very different world than the unfortunate world that we're living in today. I believe in a world where everybody, regardless of their immigration status, regardless of their race, regardless of their socioeconomic background, right, can live with dignity, with respect, and with justice, and with safety, and with belonging. Just a place where we can belong and we can be ourselves, right? Without fear of retaliation, without fear of knowing if we're going to like make ends meet, without fear of knowing that in 30 years, maybe our planet won't be around in the same way that we see it today. That to me is true justice, true social and economic justice.
And in the end, Claudia, if you were to define the United States of America in a word or a sentence, how would you do that?
Promise is my word.
Ah.
Because although right now things, again, feel really heavy because they are very heavy, there is I see hope, right, in the young people that I think I have the best job in the world because I get to almost like shut that down of what's happening, like those awful headlines.
How do you shut it down?
By doing this work, by being engaged, by feeling like I can take the feelings that I'm having, right, that anger, that frustration into action, working alongside other young people who are leading me in this next chapter in America's history. They're leading us. They're ready and they're there. And so to me, that is promise.
Thank you so much, Claudia. Thank you for the incredible work that you're doing. Where can people find information about Move Texas? Are there websites? Are there any resources you want to share with listeners, especially those, again, who are scared right now?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you're interested in learning more about our organization and to even access some of these resources, you can visit movetexas.org. That is our website. We're also on Instagram and on TikTok. Search us Move Texas and we'll pop right up. We constantly do share day-to-day resources for community members and ways in which you can plug in into the work. If you're feeling that, you know, like that frustration, if you're feeling that anger, if you're feeling like overwhelmed by everything that you're seeing, know that communities like Move Texas are standing with you. We're fighting for your rights. And we're ensuring that if you want to come and join this movement, that we are not making it overwhelming for you. My advice to people is to do something small, something activisty, like small every single day, because it creates a difference and it sends a ripple effect. A message to all immigrant communities also is that you're not alone. And a message to all the people who are not immigrants is letting them know that this fight is not just about immigrants, it's truly about who we are as a state and as a nation.
Thank you, Claudia. This was wonderful. And to non-immigrants, again, the only difference between you and us is the time we landed. That's it.
That's it.
But thank you so much, Claudia. This was wonderful. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
I am so glad we had this conversation. Claudia's energy is infectious. I felt so good after having this chat with her. There's a lot of information to process. So take a minute, listen to it, maybe re-listen if you haven't caught up on something. Share it with people that you think may benefit from it. So please, please, please spread the word. Check out Claudia's organization, Move Texas. What Claudia said resonated with me so much. Just make those tiny baby steps every day to make a change. It doesn't have to be big, you know, activism stuff. It can be those tiny little activisty things. I don't know if this word exists, but why not? We've created a new word. Anyways, thank you so much for spending this time with me and to be part of this conversation. You can follow us on our socials. You can look at our website to get more information about what Immigrantly is doing. Come back next week when I have another guest. This episode was produced and written by me, Sadia Khan. The editorial review is done by Shay Yu. Our sound designer and editor is Lou Vaskin. Our theme music is done by Simon Hutchinson. Other music by Epidemic Sound. I will talk to you next week. Take care, be safe, and be kind.